though his tone was gentle. Are you looking for a way to live forever, Sopley? Sopley returned his gaze for a moment. Then he hid his shaggy, brownish-red head in his arms, locking his hands across his ankles, and rocked himself a little back and forth. It seemed that when he was frightened, he took this position, and when he was in it, he would not speak or take any notice of what was said. Aaron turned away from him in despair and disgust. How could they go on with Sopley for days or weeks in an 18-foot boat? It was like sharing a body with a diseased soul. Sparrowhawk came up beside Aaron in the prow and knelt with one knee on the thwart, looking into the sallow evening. He said, "The man has a gentle spirit." Aaron did not answer this. He asked coldly, "What is Oberhall? I never heard the name." "I know its name and place on the charts. No more. Look there. The Companions of Gobardon." The great topaz-colored star was higher in the south now, and beneath it, just clearing the dim sea, shone a white star to the left and a bluish-white one to the right, forming a triangle. "Have they names?" The Master Namer did not know. "Maybe the men of Oberhall and Wellergy have names for them. I do not know. We go now into strange seas, Aaron, under the sign of ending." The boy did not answer, looking with a kind of loathing at the bright, nameless stars above the endless water. As they sailed westward day after day, the warmth of the southern spring lay on the waters, and the sky was clear. Yet it seemed to Aaron that there was a dullness in the light, as if it fell aslant through glass. The sea was lukewarm when he swam, bringing little refreshment. Their salt food had no savor. There was no freshness or brightness in anything, unless it were at night, when the stars burned with a greater radiance than he had ever seen in them. He would lie and watch them till he slept. Sleeping, he would dream. Always the dream of the moors, or the pit, or a valley hemmed round by cliffs, or a long road going downward under a low sky. Always the dim light, and the horror in him, and the hopeless effort to escape. He never spoke of this to Sparrowhawk. He did not speak of anything important to him, nothing but the small daily incidents of their sailing. And Sparrowhawk, who had always had to be drawn out, was now habitually silent. Aaron saw now what a fool he had been to entrust himself, body and soul, to this restless and secretive man, who let impulse move him and made no effort to control his life, nor even to save it. For now the fey mood was on him, and that, Aaron thought, was because he dared not face his own failure, the failure of wizardry as a great power among men. It was clear now that to those who knew the secrets, there were not many secrets to that art magic from which Sparrowhawk and all the generations of sorcerers and wizards had made much fame and power. There was not much more to it than the use of wind and weather, the knowledge of healing herbs, and a skillful show of such illusions as mists and lights and shape changes, which could awe the ignorant, but which were mere tricks. Reality was not changed. There was nothing in magery that gave a man true power over men, nor was it any use against death. The mages lived no longer than ordinary men. All their secret words could not put off for 1 hour the coming of their death. Even in small matters, magery was not worth counting on. Sparrowhawk was always miserly about employing his arts. They went by the world's wind whenever they might. They fished for food, and they spared their water like any sailors. After 4 days of interminable tacking into a fitful headwind, Aaron asked him if he would not speak a little following wind into the sail, and when he shook his head, said, "Why not? I would not ask a sick man to run a race, said Sparrowhawk, nor lay a stone on an overburdened back. It was not clear whether he spoke of himself or of the world at large. Always his answers were grudging, hard to understand. There, thought Arryn, lay the very heart of wizardry. To hint at mighty meanings while saying nothing at all, and to make doing nothing at all seem the very crown of wisdom. Arryn had tried to ignore Sopley, but it was impossible. And in any case, he soon found himself in a kind of alliance with the madman. Sopley was not so mad, or not so simply mad, as his wild hair and fragmented talk made him appear. Indeed, the maddest thing about him was perhaps his terror of the water. To come into a boat had taken desperate courage, and he never really got the edge worn off his fear. He kept his head down so much that he would not have to see the water heaving and lapping about him. To stand up in the boat made him giddy. He clung to the mast. The first time Arryn decided on a swim and dived off the prow, Sopley shouted out in horror. When Arryn came climbing back into the boat, the poor man was green with shock. "I thought you were drowning yourself," he said, and Arryn had to